Hello and welcome to another episode of the Yang Gang Podcast. I am your co-host, Connor Mabon. My other host, Evan, unfortunately will not join us this week. He is out of town, but I am happy to introduce our guest this afternoon, Dr. Giselle Huff. She is the president of the Gerald Huff Fund for Humanity, a nonprofit promoting universal basic income as a transitional solution to the threat of technological unemployment. She has also had an extensive career serving on numerous boards of directors, including the International Association for K-12 Online Learning, and is the recipient of the Thomas A. Rowe Award, honoring those in the state public policy movement whose achievements have greatly advanced free market philosophy. Dr. Huff, how are you this afternoon?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
We are as well. Thank you again for your time. We know you're a busy lady. Before we delve into some of the questions that I have, I was wondering if you can maybe elaborate on your background. What inspired or motivated you to begin working in things like public policy?
So I'm an immigrant. I came to this country as a child right after the Second World War. I'm French, and I was born in Paris, where 18 members of my family were killed in the Holocaust. So my mother and I came to America with $400 to our name, not speaking any English. And I am here where I am today because of the 20th century American dream. Mm-hmm. That was a real thing then. There is no way that I would have achieved what I've achieved in this country anywhere else in the world. I'm a good friend of Jeb Bush's and of Governor Bob Wise, who was the governor of West Virginia. Mm-hmm. And this was unimaginable for a little girl who didn't speak English and who came here with her mother and with two suitcases full of clothes, and that was it. That's the typical American dream story. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I have a great faith in this country and a great love for this country, not to mention the fact that it was the American GIs who saved us. You know, It was without them, we'd all be speaking German. So basically, I feel very strongly about this country and the opportunities it offers. But in the course of the 21st century, things have begun to go awry. And I was a lifelong libertarian as a self-made woman. It's always been my idea that if you play by the rules and you work hard, you can make it, because I did. Mm-hmm. I didn't work that hard, by the way. There was a lot of luck involved. And there was also making the best of opportunities, which is something else than working hard. Mm-hmm. Working hard is another concept. So I made this wonderful life for myself with my late husband. And I moved to California in 1977 with my young son, who was at the time 14 years old, and my daughter, who was in college in Colorado Springs. And I started a career as the director of development at a private high school here in San Francisco, after having gotten my PhD from Columbia University in political philosophy. So I've always been interested in public policy. Mm-hmm. And when I retired to Marin. I had lost my husband to pancreatic cancer in 1977, mm-hmm. when he was 1987, 77 is when he came here. Mm-hmm. He was 54 years old at the time. And when I was, after I retired from high school, and I remarried and moved to Marin, and I decided to run for Congress because I was bored. I couldn't be retired. Mm-hmm. So I ran for Congress as a Republican in 1998. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And lost in the primary, and was then hired as the director of the executive director of a small family foundation here in San Francisco that was concerned with education. So So I've been in the education, first reform, then transformation field for 22 years. And in I was going along my merry way, always, you know, kind of very independent in terms of politics, very interested in politics, but really tending more Republican than Democrat, because although I'm a totally, because as a libertarian, I'm a totally, you know, socially, I don't care what you do, as long as you don't bother me. I was always very wary of government and its ability to do anything effective. So I was always a small government person and thus a libertarian. And then 2008 happened. And that was a real revelation for me. And it was through my son Gerald's guidance through that period and his making clear to me that there were no more bootstraps, that America, the American dream was essentially dead, that the system was so rigged and so badly run, so not responsive to the people it was supposed to support, that you couldn't really blame the people.
Right.
And it was completely, totally transformed me. And it's very hard to imagine that a woman at my age, that was, you know, 10 years ago, I was 73, could change her entire viewpoint of the world. But it was Gerald who guided me through this. And of course, the reason I started this nonprofit called the Gerald Health for Humanity is because I decided that I had to continue talking about the things he cared so deeply about, one being the threat of technological unemployment and the other being using universal basic income as a transitional way of making sure there was no blood in the streets.
Right. So you are continuing his work, his ideas, honoring him through this Fund for Humanity. I did do a little bit of research into your son and saw that he had written a book about these things. I was curious as to, did you know how he was introduced to these ideas? I saw that he had worked through some pretty big tech companies.
Yes, he was a principal software engineer at Tesla for the Model 3.
Wow.
So he was the head of the team that made the car a computer, you know, the way Teslas are. He came to UBI as because of the threat of technological unemployment. That was his main, his understanding of the world was that technology was going to change everything and potentially could change everything to the benefit of everyone, but potentially could change everything into dystopias of the first order. And his first introduction to all of this was through the books, you know, the Second Machine Age, the Age of the Robots, the people who were writing about the coming, the robots are coming. That's what, and he understood that because he was part of that world. It was a world that was very, very clear to him. I mean, it was something that he could totally understand.
He saw the he saw the trajectory of where it was going.
Absolutely. And and as a matter of fact, so he found out about UBI. He was a brilliant man, and he was, you know, constantly following trends and doing deep research, and in addition to doing his job, of course. And he came upon UBI a long time ago, probably in around 2012. And he decided to write a book, to a techno thriller, to make people aware of this. He, much as I did when I started looking at UBI as it is going on now and its history, he perceived that there was not a something that was that walled off people's tongues. You know, it was like a non-thing. Mm-hmm. No one talked about it. People never talked about automation or technological unemployment. It was a topic that was not in the zeitgeist. So he decided that he was going to write a book that was going to describe what could happen 20 years from now if we didn't heed the writing on the wall.
And that book is titled Crisis 2038.
Correct.
Will technology ever benefit us all? Now, I'm curious as to what was your initial reaction to this idea of automation, of what is being called the fourth industrial revolution? And what was your reaction to all of this and to universal basic income, this idea?
Well, as he was going through this, he was giving me all the books to read. So I read all the books too, and I agreed with him. I mean, especially after 2008, 2009, you couldn't not realize that major shifts were happening in the economy and that capitalism and the American dream were not living up to their hype.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the current work going on with the Fund for Humanity? Any like the current projects? I saw that you have the basic income today.
Correct. I just wanted to interject here, just as a sideline.
No, of course.
And that is that actually Gerald got Andrew Yang, who, as you know, is a Democratic candidate who is the only one who's championing UBI. Mm-hmm. He got Andrew to write a blurb for his book, which reads, Crisis 2038 is a fascinating account of our near future. Only someone who is actively engaged in building the future like Gerald Huff could have crafted such a detailed look at what awaits us as a people and a society.
Wow.
That's Andrew Yang's quote on the back of the book.
Wow.
So Gerald brought me along. I was, you know, he gave me all the books he read, and I read all the books, and I was just as convinced as he was.
Mm-hmm.
And he began to really be quite active in talking about UBI and talking about technological unemployment. He was on a panel at the Milken Institute Global Conference in 2015, where he talked about this, and he continued to do that. And then he died last year in 2018. And the whole, so creating the Gerald Huff Fund for Humanity was trying to articulate in a much more specific way, because he had a very important day job and I have a lot of time. articulate what he was aiming at with the book, trying to wake people up and make them aware of what was going on, and also participating in making UBI a part of the national conversation.
Right.
Which it wasn't when he started and didn't really become even a glimpse of something until Andrew Yang started talking about it.
So it seems like your son has been quite the source of inspiration. I know it seemed like I feel compelled. I have to read this book now. And I hope that I encourage all of my, the Yang Gang podcast listeners to do the same. And anyone interested who is listening on universal basic income automation to definitely please check that book out.
Yes, and it's available on Amazon in every form known to man. It's an audio book, it's a Kindle book, it's a down, I mean, you can read it any way you like.
Mm-hmm.
But the other things that the fund is invested in is, I actually sponsored the New York City, Basic Income March. We started way back in early September, late August, and it was just a gleam in somebody's eyes, but there was no money behind it. And this is the thing with UBI in general. although there's been a lot of stuff going on for 25 years, it's all been done by volunteers. And money talks.
Yes, it does.
Only money talks. I mean, you can get people in the street screaming and all of that. That helps too. There are a lot of things you could do that are not, that don't cost money. But if you want things to move forward, you have to be able to, bring money to the table when it's necessary. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did with the march in New York, and that's what I'm doing in a much smaller way with the march in San Francisco, which is happening on October 27th.
Right. I was going to ask if you will be attending.
Yes, I will be speaking, actually. So this is a dressed rehearsal for me.
Oh, lovely. Well, we are definitely going to make it a point of meeting you. But do you know what you'll be speaking on yet? Is it kind of more or less what we've been chatting about? Is there anything else that we can get a little snippet of?
Oh, yes. I mean, so I'll be, of course, I'll have much less time than here because there are other speakers involved. Mm-hmm. And I'll briefly describe why I got involved with Gerald's story. And then I will speak about UBI per se, as you know, I talk about the need for it to be universal, because Warren Buffett is an American too.
Mm-hmm.
And I will talk about, what Gerald outlines and, goes through in his book, which is the way technology has helped personkind to get to where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to rein it in. We have to get a hold of it and make sure that it benefits everybody. So UBI is a first step towards making that happen. And the reason it's so important is because you need a mind shift to happen. We have to get away from the idea that we are what we do. We are what we are. What we do should be incidental. I mean, Keynes thought that by now, 2019, we'd be working 15 hours a week. We're working 70 hours a week. And some of us are working that amount of time and still can't make ends meet. Mm-hmm. By the way, cavemen worked 15 hours a week. So I'm going to be talking about the fact that, we could be going to an age of abundance if we use technology the right way. And that in order to bring our humanity forward, we have to stop people from thinking that giving people money is a handout. It's more than that, because we're at a stage in the development of technology where, if nanotechnology gets developed, as some people are thinking, maybe by the end of this century, money will not mean anything, because everything, think about what nanotechnology is. It's rearranging atoms. So you essentially could take anything, a sofa, and make it into a 2-3-piece suit. So you could recycle endlessly. You would never have to touch another resource on Earth. I mean, you would solve a million problems. Of course, there are people who say that nanotechnology has pitfalls, but I'm not a scientist and I can't go there. I'm just saying that the concept of, money and the seeking of money to define who you are will go out the window. Who you are will be defined by what your relationships are with other human beings. By how many cars you own or many houses you have.
Right, and I wanted to go back to an earlier point you had made about a mental shift, a mindset shift. And I've heard this on previous podcast episodes with other guests talking about this shift from the scarcity to the abundance mindset.
Right.
Not only on an individual level, but on a collective community and societal level, it seems like we do have this scarcity mentality. And I mean, even look at the economics, everything is shifted to one corner of the society, where only a select few seem to be benefiting, while the vast majority seem to be left out of it. So,
yes,
I guess my question is, how do you think we can ameliorate that?
Well, we have to start. So when you're trying to shift people's mindset, it's probably one of the hardest things to do in the world. I mean, it takes inordinate amounts of time. I mean, how did we get women's suffrage? How many decades did that take? And we had to shift mind, you know, men's minds had to be shifted that women were completely complete idiots and that they couldn't be trusted to vote for somebody. How did we get to gay marriage? How many decades did that take?
Too many to count.
And this is in modern times. Right? Actually, before that, nothing happened. We had, you know, men ruling the earth since the caves, and then nothing happened. I mean, we had Catherine the Great, and we had Queen Victoria, but that doesn't mean anything. I'm talking about all of the institutions that were created, all of the paradigms that were created. All of those are man-made, and I mean that man-made. I don't mean person-made. I mean man-made.
Right.
So, you know, shifting people's minds takes an inordinate amount of time. I don't know that we have that much time. I hope we do. But we have to make people understand that we all share. I know this is one of the mantras, you know, that is part of the climate change movement. The whole idea that there's no boundaries for this, right? It doesn't matter if you live in America, you're going to die just the same as people in China or anywhere else, because this is not a national problem. It's a global problem. So in order to get people to change their minds about this Protestant ethic that is in our bones, it's in the American, you know, legend, the bootstraps and, you know, settling the West and all of those memes that are part of our history. And our DNA, I mean, as American, and even people who come here because they're more like that than not. They're the people who get on the boats, the people who, you know, walk for 2,000 miles. Those are not the people who stay at home.
Right. They're the ones, yeah, they are the ones pulling the bootstraps up. So it's almost like a reinvigoration of this idea. And we're not talking about like I feel like we're not talking about like a physical frontier like we were, like, you know, going west. It's now this new frontier, a technological frontier, something that's going to really require us to shift our mindset, open it to a new possibility. So how can people get involved, maybe specifically with the Fund for Humanity? Is there ways for people to get involved, maybe to help the effort in expanding this into the national conversation, helping with this mind shift?
Absolutely. Well, for one thing, people can come to the march in San Francisco. You know, I think that going to the streets helps too. Everything helps. Everything. Everyone's contribution counts. Even if it's, you know, on Twitter, or on Facebook, or just spreading the word, right? Just talking about this whenever you meet somebody, talking about UBI, having these conversations. For instance, one of the things that the fund is doing is I'm going to exhibit at the Libertarian Conference, the State Policy Network, next week, where Scott Sentence and I are going, and we're going to spin our spiel. We're going to talk to 1,300 libertarians about UBI.
Wow.
And we have a booth, and on the banner of the booth are pictures and quotes from Thomas Paine, Frederick Hayek, Milton Friedman, and Charles Murray.
Now, I'm curious, and maybe we could just touch briefly on this, because I just only had a few more questions before we wrapped up today. I was curious about, because I understand that this was an idea that was floating around during the Nixon administration. Do you have, are you able to elaborate on maybe why that fell through?
Well, that was an earned income credit.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit different than...
It's a little bit different because, in fact, I just wrote an editorial for USA Today a couple of weeks ago. I was asked to respond to their pushing for an earned income credit. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to make the case for UBI as an alternative, which I did because I think an earned income credit doesn't get us to what Gerald and I want to get to, which is it's not about the job. If the earned income credit is based on you having a job and then getting, having the government make it up between the amount you make on your job and the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that do about abused women who can't leave because they don't have any money at all? What does it do about released felons who can't get a job? What does it do about, foster youth who at the age of 18 are kicked out on the street and go fend for yourself? What does it do for the people who with a little bit of capital could become great contributors? Nothing.
Right.
Because it depends on a job. So at the time in under Nixon, this was an idea of Milton Friedman's, and Nixon, there was a whole political thing around it, but it didn't pass. It passed in the House and it didn't pass in the Senate. Twice, I believe. So it was a political football, as almost everything is these days.
Mm-hmm.
But this UBI is I'm going to quote Andrew. It's not left. It's not right. It's forward.
Oh yeah, that's our walk off for the podcast.
Yeah.
It's great because I love that humanity first idea of his, and that like we're all in this together. That's
correct.
That's not like a woo woo idea. That's like we really truly are, especially facing these times of uncertainty with technological unemployment coming down the pipeline. Now, I guess one of my final questions I have for you,
yes,
before we mention the UBI march in San Francisco and things like that. I might have to edit this out because I lost my train of thought. Oh, no.
That happened to me a lot.
I don't think I'll remember at this point. We'll edit that out. But so you will be attending, you will be speaking at the Universal Basic Income March in San Francisco. It begins at 12:30 p.m. at the Civic Center Plaza. What time will you be speaking?
So we are going to start marching around 1:15, 1:30, mm-hmm, because we're marching down Market Street. Then we'll probably come back by 2:45 or so, and that's when the speeches will start.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be speaking probably around 3:00.
Around 3:00, and then I
know
that...
Yeah, but we want everybody to march because that's how you show support.
Right.
Market Street is such a well-known place for people marching up and down.
Mm-hmm.
We have marches very often on Market Street, and we're hoping that we draw a big crowd and people hold up their signs and people up and down Market Street can see us in action rather than just statically being, at the Civic Center.
Because you never know. That's when you introduce, someone's going to inquire about
Correct.
That. They're going to research it, and then they're going to tell a friend. Like, that really is how political change or societal change does happen. It's in
That's
this,
right.
the small conversations, and obviously it can balloon into things like marches and eventually public policy and stuff like that. And I know Andrew Yang will be making a guest appearance. I believe that is why there was
making a guest appearance. He's actually at a half hour later. He's going to have a rally that is sponsored by the campaign and doesn't have anything to do with us.
Mm.
We just piggyback, we started the march. We were going to have the march, and so he's coming into town. I guess he'll be here on Friday, Sunday,
mm-hmm,
and the campaign, I guess, decided to have a rally at the same place. It's the only place in San Francisco because the Halliday Plaza is now the skating rink.
Ah,
right.
Mm. I think I think I remembered my question. And then and then we can wrap it up. But if Andrew Yang, and of course I'm I and much of our audience is hoping that he does win. In the event that he does not win, when do you think this idea of universal basic income could be implemented on a national level? Do you think it's going to get to, like, it's going to have to get to a point that's so bad that it forces a politician's hand to implement it? Or do you think it will be like with Andrew Yang doing, kind of getting ahead of it?
So part of the plan for the Gerald Huff Fund for Humanity is precisely to be there regardless of what happens. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if he wins and it's, you know, that everything will go according to what he has in mind. I have now, you know, as the president, he'll have a lot to say about this. But if he doesn't win, we can't let this moment go by.
Right.
We can't let this sink. Mm-hmm. Every person who was a member of the gang is going to have to become a UBI proponent, mm-hmm. big time.
That's where
the fund is going to fund that.
That's where we see our podcast actually starting to evolve into. It's like we started with just, you know, supporting Andrew Yang's campaign and his messages and his policy proposals to now speaking with and being introduced to, you know, on a deeper level, universal basic income advocates and a little bit deeper into the philosophy. So in saying that, we really appreciate the work that you are doing. As well as your colleagues in this realm, and for our audience, for the Yang Gang podcast audience, we got to do exactly what Dr. Gisele Huff has said about when we can't let this fizzle out. We need to continue our efforts and stay involved, even in the smallest way. So, on that note, thank you so much for a fantastic conversation. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
It's been my pleasure as well, Connor. Thank you.
That was Dr. Gisele Huff. She is the president of the Gerald Huff Fund for Humanity, a nonprofit promoting universal basic income as a transitional solution to the threat of technological employment. You can find more information on the fundforhumanity.org. Is there anything else you would like to mention before we sign off today?
No. I just mentioned my son's mantra. Mm-hmm. Think big, start small, move fast.
Love that. Well, on that note, we will wrap it up. And again, thank you so much for a fantastic conversation. We hope to keep a line open with you in the future. And we look forward to the Universal Basic Income March. That is Sunday, October 27th, beginning at 12:30 p.m., meeting at the Civic Center Plaza. Dr. Gisele Huff will be speaking around 3 o'clock, and we hope everyone turns out. I know me and Evan will be there, and we hope to meet you.
All right, I mean, look forward to it.
All righty. Well, thank you again, and we will talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.